Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
My name is Michael Hesse. I'm the director of the Heliophysics Science Division here at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, where I have the pleasure to work with 300 highly talented individuals on the science of the sun and its interaction with the interplanetary medium and the magnetic electric fields of the planets, and that includes space weather. So what are my primary research interests and what do I like most about it? Well, I'm a what I call a space plasma physicist, so I'm interested in fundamental processes in space that essentially determine how space works, how charged particles and electromagnetic fields interact in space. Now, I like that for two reasons. The first is that it is simply scientifically challenging. It's basic science applied to a medium that we as humankind have a great interest in. Has interesting science problems to solve everywhere, and I find it challenging and fascinating to solve those. The other reason I enjoy this is space weather, and that means really that what we're doing here has very practical applications for humankind. Space is not just benign and interesting and nice to look at. If you look at the stars, it also has potentially harmful effects on humans, their equipment, and implications for humankind, you know, as for humans in space and the assets in space as well as on the ground. And that means that what you're doing as part of your research translates more or less directly into something that's societally relevant, and that is something that the public is greatly excited about, and it's fascinating to not only do basic research, but do basic research that has this kind of value. Well, in many ways, this started, for me, maybe the mid-90s or so. I was involved in what is referred to as the Geospace Environment Modeling Project. It was funded by the National Science Foundation, which is looking into generating what they called a geospace general circulation model, which is an equivalent of what you do for the atmosphere, but then for geospace. And it was realized as part of this creation of such a model would have implications also for the space environment and would have utility for space environment specification and forecasting. Everything was in its infancy at the time. At the same time, it was also realized that for such a model to exist and have a maximum benefit, it would be extremely useful to have a facility which would host such a model or such models and make those available for the science community, evaluate those models and test them and perhaps facilitate that transition into space weather forecasting. And that facility was created here at Goddard. It was, turned out to be the Community Coordinated Modeling Center, and I was the founding director of that activity. It was officially inaugurated in 2000, but the work that led to it began much earlier in the 90s. In various community activities where this concept was discussed and evolved and preparatory negotiations between the DoD, NSF and NASA and other agencies took place. So there was a lot of work being done in preparation of that and emerged out of the GEM program in many ways, but then grew to encompass much more. And this facility was then created with the objective to do exactly what I said earlier, namely to serve scientists across the world, but also to exploit models insofar as they are capable to aid in space weather forecasting. And that has been the guiding principle. And that's really how I got into space weather, coming from the basic science side. There was an interagency consortium that had a number of agencies on them. Some of them were on the science side, like NASA and NSF, and some of them on the space weather side, like the Air Force and NOAA. And it was a very pleasant interaction at the beginning where we all worked together to see how we can get the maximum benefit out of this, out of what comes from the research side and this new activity to essentially support space weather modeling. Yeah. So that's how I got into that. My role then, I've been the director of this until 2 years ago or so, evolved from inception of the program to participating in research activities of staff who are evaluating models under different conditions, you know, to guiding the overall activity, to now include space weather forecasting for NASA. My division and an attachment to the CCMC, the Space Weather Research Center, is now the dedicated space weather provider for NASA. There's continued and much expanded testing of models and evaluations with the scientific community. There are great support for the DoD model evaluations for NOAA and so on that are going on a routine basis. I participated in many of those directly or indirectly as leading the activity in during that time, and now I'm supporting it from the division director level. I mean, I think initially in the 90s, we weren't quite as advanced in our recognition how far our technological systems are susceptible to space weather. I think that recognition grew as a function of time, kind of along with the growth of our capabilities to address those. Not to say that we don't have much more to do there, but we have learned to do much better than we did at that time. But I think it's fair enough to say that initially the push to do this came from the science community rather than from the operational community. There was a much stronger push in the science community and recognition that this could be turned into something useful for space weather than it was in the operational community at the time. What is now called the Space Weather Workshop, the annual event, was actually grew out of something that one of the leaders of the GEM program, George Sisko, created a workshop that brought together potential interested customers in space weather together with scientists and modelers to see what their needs were and whether the models could be evolved. That is unfortunately not very often recognized. It was George Sisko who had this vision and actually carried it forward. Yeah, and that then evolved into something that was then later picked up by NOAA. But initially, this basically came from the science community. Yeah, so that tells you that at that time, at least as far as I can see, the societal relevance was not nearly as much accepted as it is now. You know, as the interaction between potential customers and scientists and operators and so on grew, more and more information flew across those boundaries and much more became known. So in the early 90s, when the GEM program was created, I think there were very few people who had the vision that it could lead, that this model development activity could lead to the value that it now everybody believes it has. Now we are in a completely different world there. I mean, I believe it was the same in the meteorological world. You know, as your capabilities grow, people start to understand, you know, you can use that for things that you didn't really realize you would have any means of dealing with. Yeah. So, no, you're right with your question. I think at that time, we were much less aware of how important space weather it is than we are now. I think the key event was the inception of the GEM program. I mean, this really, from a development and scientific point of view, was breaking completely new ground. You know, it was then later followed by the CEDAR and SHINE programs, which developed similar foci, you know. But the GEM program, with its key focus on developing modeling capabilities, was really perhaps the major stepping stone in terms of developing capabilities that existed. Then an avalanche of further activities followed, modeling programs support programs like the Targeted Research and Technology Program, which really infused major money into this. Then took this potential and provided the foundation to actually turn it into more and more products. But the recognition, the idea to do this and that could be done originated in the GEM program, and that is often forgotten. And it cannot be said often enough. And again, the person to credit with that is George Sisko. NASA, you know, with Dick Fisher coming into getting to headquarters and being supportive of space weather research with a targeted research and technology program, stepped up to the plate and not only joined NSF in supporting it, but provided a major amount of financial support to researchers to develop that. And that program has and continues to make a substantial difference in our capabilities. But I'm only talking about models. You know, what we really need to look for is data. You can model anything you want if you don't have the data resources. And there, from a forecasting point of view, we still couldn't really forecast any impact of solar eruptions if we weren't observing the sun. And perhaps the most important of all assets ever developed is SOHO, a joint ESA-NASA mission that is still operating and hopefully will continue to do so for a while. You know, additional major stepping stones are the STEREO spacecraft, which let us for the first time ever look at coronal mass ejections stereoscopically and therefore provide much higher accuracy, giving inputs to models to then predict their continuation of evolution. I mean, the ACE spacecraft that lets us monitor the impact near the Earth or so, without which we would have no clue what is actually arriving at the magnetosphere. Basically, the fleet of primarily NASA spacecraft, actually, not to forget GOES, of course, and POSE and the DMSP spacecraft from the DoD side. I mean, that really, from a data point of view, you know, from ground truth as well as driving models, has been invaluable for space weather. So if you want to look at key times after which things change, you can look at the launch dates of those missions. I mean, that's basically when this new capability became available and will continue to be available for a while. Well, in research, I mean, there's two questions, really. One is, how do we provide data continuity or evolve data continuity, if you want? And the other one is, which research questions are there and how do we address them? Mm-hmm. And I would maintain that, unlike terrestrial weather, where we have a very solid physical and chemical understanding of the basic processes that determine weather, we are not nearly there in space weather. There are many fundamental problems that we simply don't understand. We're making progress in our understanding how particles are accelerated, which is a key phenomenon in the magnetosphere and the radiation belts, you know, with the Van Allen probes. But one of the key questions we basically still have any clue, competing theories, but which one is right, is how energetic particles in the solar atmosphere get accelerated. You know, the solar energetic particles that are a major hazard. We don't understand how coronal mass ejection is being created and ejected. There are theories, competing theories. We have currently unable to resolve those, and maybe there's more than one solution. So, I mean, these are just examples of basic scientific questions that one would have to understand if we want to do reliable prediction of space weather. So space weather is, unlike terrestrial weather, a research activity, first and foremost a research activity. The name in many ways is a misnomer because it suggests something that really isn't there, that space weather is like terrestrial weather, you know, where, okay, you refine things, you make them better and better. Here we are at ground zero in many cases. You know, we don't have the answer. We don't have the basic fundamental answer. So much research is needed in order to further space weather. If we quit that now, we're stuck in the Stone Age, relatively speaking. Yeah, the other thing is data continuity. For research as well as for operational purposes, we need data continuity. And there's pretty much, at the present time, no plan on how to do that. We have these existing assets that we use. You know, none of them are, with the exception of GOES and POSE and DMSP and so on, most of them are not what anyone would call operational or designed to provide continuity ad infinitum. Mm-hmm. And we currently have no plan on how to continue that. We need to find a way to do that. If the country takes it seriously, we'll have to find a way to do it. Yeah. I don't want to speculate here what the answer is to that, but it is an outstanding problem that we need to solve. In order to forecast, we're going to have to do it. And also in order to answer many of the science questions that are still outstanding, we need that information. And so we're going to have to deal with that. How that's going to be dealt with is something to be determined. I'm optimistic that we will find a way to do it.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Day's themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.